Okay, we're starting Parshas Vayera this week, page 78 in the Chumash. One of the great Rosh HaYeshiva of pre-war Europe, his name was Rabbi Chanan Wasserman Zatzal. He was met untimely death at the hands of the Nazis. He was shot down. He was one of the most conscientious Rosh HaYeshiva, great Torah leaders that we had, in the sense that every second of his life, it had a purpose, meaning he never just relaxed. He didn't engage in conversation. Every single second was purposeful, and every action was purposeful. So with that kind of person, when you were in his presence, you just became better. You were very afraid of doing something that was not purposeful in his presence due to the way he might look at you. And it wasn't that he was a stern and foreboding individual. The opposite. He was an engaging individual. When he came to America on a fundraising trip, he made sure that his host taught him how to say good morning in English so that when he greeted people, you know, just strangers on the sidewalk, he'd be able to greet them nicely and talk to people. So he was a people person in that sense. But everything he did was very intentional. But again, it was just being in his presence. The presence alone commanded some... You were in this almost near tangible, you know, aura of conscientiousness, where whatever you did, you were a better person when you were standing next to him, and this played out even in his death, as when he and the group of Jews he was with were being led to the to be shot down by the Nazis. Normally, in such a scene, you have those who are crying and those who are trying to escape, those who are begging. They're, you know, the pantheon of human emotion that runs at such an extreme time of duress. But that was not Rabbi Chanan, and all the Jews who were with him, because they were in his presence, that's not who they were either. As they went, as they were herded and marched to the pit where they were going to be shot, he gave them a Musar Shmuz, almost like a speech about why they're being killed and what purpose it's serving and how they can meet their death with grace and honor. And everybody was awestruck. And quietly, with dignity, and with Kiddush Hashem, every single person there was shot and killed.
How old was he?
He was, when he died, he most probably was in his late 60s, around 70 maybe, something like that. Yeah. The concept of appearance, of just a presence being there and affecting how we feel about ourselves, is present right at the beginning of this parsha. We read the first pasuk, Vayera Elav Hashem. Hashem appeared to him. Who's the him here? The him is Avraham. Going on the last parsha, the last thing we learned about was that Avraham gave himself a bris milah with Hashem's command. And then as in the post, you know, operation, Hashem appeared to him. Be'elonei Mamre, in the trees of Mamre, v'hu yoshe pesach ha'ohel, and Avram was sitting at the entrance of the tent, kechom hayom, with the heat of the day. If we look in Rashi, the top Rashi, v'yera ilav, and he appeared to him. Hashem appeared to Avram. Why? Levakar as hachola, to visit the sick, because there's a mitzvah to visit the sick. Amar Rebbe Chama Bar Chanina Yom Shlishi Milaso Haya. It was the third day after Abraham had received the bris. Ubal Kadosh Baruch Hu V'Shal B'Shlomo. So Hashem came to greet him. How does Rashi know this? Obviously, he's quoting a medrash, a chazal. But what did Chazal see in this pasuk that it's referring to Bikur Cholam, that the visit was what's important as opposed to the message? The answer is, the Mefarshim explained, that if you continue reading, it says, then Avram lifted his eyes, he saw people there, and he decided to do the mitzvah of bringing in, you know, guests. Hashem doesn't tell him anything, right? It's just an appearance without a speech. Hashem is just there. His presence is just there. So what's going on? Why would Hashem come then? So we look at what happened previously. Avram was sick. He was in pain from his bris milah, and Hashem shows up. What else is Hashem showing up for if not to make Avram feel better, to do the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim? This actually gives us some insight into what the mitzvah Bikur Cholim is. A lot of times when we translate Bikur Cholim, we translate visiting the sick. So that's not actually such an accurate translation of the word Bikur. Bikur really means attending to the sick, that you're taking care of them, not just visiting them. Unfortunately, the notion of visiting has become sort of enshrined in the way we think about this mitzvah, and we impose our presence on sick people often when they don't want it, right? What do you mean? I'm visiting you. Enjoy it, right? So, but when the Gemara talks about it, it says that's not how you do the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. It says there are two main components of Bikur Cholim if you want to fulfill the mitzvah. The first is, and it quotes a long story with Rabbi Akiva, is taking care of the sick person's needs. The Gemara records how Rabbi Akiva visited one of his students and who was very sick, hadn't come to yeshiva for a while, and then he saw he was in his small wooden home and it was dark. And, you know, the student was bedridden. He couldn't take care of himself. So things were messy. There were dishes in the sink, whatever the equivalent was. So Rabbi Akiva, the great gadol hador, went and he swept and he cleaned up and opened the shades and let light in and made it a home where healing could occur, as opposed to just wallowing being sick by somebody who couldn't take care of themselves. So that's the first definition of Bikur Cholim. What does that person who's sick really need? Like, what would benefit them, and how can I do that to help them get better? It could be they need companionship, but that's often the least of it. When a person's sick, they just want to be better. So what can you do to help accomplish that? The second element is praying for them, davening for them, the Gemara says. And actually that impacts the halacha of the mitzvah as well. The Gemara says you shouldn't visit somebody very early in the morning, because when a person first wakes up after a good night's sleep, they're refreshed and they might have a little more energy, even in the face of their sickness, than their sickness normally allows for. So if you visit them when they first wake up, they're having their coffee, they have that 10-minute window of positive optimism before the day wears on them, you might not think they're in such a bad situation. You're like, okay, this guy's doing okay. So the Gemara says, don't visit them first thing in the morning. Neither should you visit them at night at the end of the day, because after a grueling day of being sick, it takes its toll, and a person looks like they're out of it at the end, at which point you might give up hope, like saying, I can't do anything for this person anymore. So the Gemara says, visit them in the middle. There will be that perfect combination of, they're sick, but there's hope, and therefore I'm inspired to daven for them, to help utilize that hope. Here also, Hashem appears to Abraham, and apparently that's all that was needed. Abraham didn't need anything else. He was taken care of, and just Hashem's presence alone was everything Abraham needed in order to get better. So Hashem didn't say anything. It was purely for the sake of Abraham realizing that Hashem was by his side. If we look in the next Rashi, this under the second line, Be'elonei Mamre, this happened in the trees in the land of Mamre. So who is Mamre? So Hushanasan lo Eitz al Hamila. Mamre was one of Avram's confidants who gave him advice, counsel regarding the Mila. Lefikach nigla ela bechelko. So therefore, as a reward for that, because Mamre told Avram to go ahead with the Mila, Hashem rewarded Mamre by choosing Mamre's area, his location, in which to reveal himself to Abraham. Meaning Mamre was zocha to Hashem's presence because he told Abraham to listen to Mamre. The Medrash Tanchuma here, which Rashi's giving us like a one-line synopsis of a much longer Medrash, actually says that there was an extensive conversation between Abraham and his confidants, that his advisors. When Abraham was told by Hashem to take the bris milah, The Medrash says that Avraham went to his neighbors, his friends, and he asked, should I do this? So who were those neighbors? They were Er, Eshkol, and Mamre. Three people who are mentioned in the Chumash, three leaders of the time. So Er told him, even though Hashem said to do so, you cannot do so. Why? Because at your advanced age, having a bris milah is going to weaken you to some degree. And then because of that, because you're going to be incapacitated, you're just coming off a war where you went to war with a lot of countries, which we learned about previously. And they're still really angry at you. So if they sense an opening that there's that you're not able to defend yourself at the moment, they're going to swoop in like you're not going to believe and take advantage of that situation, right? We see that playing out in modern day politics. When a country suddenly loses its ability to defend itself, everybody rushes in to take advantage of the situation. So that's what Anar told Avram, do not give yourself the milah. You're putting yourself at risk from those who you went to war with. Then Avram went to Eshkol and he said, should I do this thing which God said? And Eshkol said, even though obviously it would seem to be the right thing to do, but God doesn't want you to kill yourself, Avraham. You're at an advanced age. You're going to be losing a lot of blood with this operation. It's a circumcision, and obviously medicine of the day was not the it's not like we have it today, so why would you put yourself, mamash pikuach nefesh, put your life on the line for this? We know you're not supposed to kill yourself for the sake of mitzvahs. So this mitzvah, it could kill you. Therefore, obviously you shouldn't do it. So he said, fine. And then Avram went to Mamre and asked Mamre, should I do the milah? And Mamre says, how can you even ask the question? Who's telling you to do the milah? It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's Hashem. Hashem has been by your side in a miraculous way, which is obvious. You just went to war against four nations, and Kamat single-handedly, you won, and you were saved from the fiery furnace, and all these miracles are happening to you. Obviously, God is taking care of you in ways that he doesn't take care of other people. So if he says to do this one thing for him, obviously you do it. What's the question? Obviously, he's going to protect you while doing this mitzvah. So Avram said, fine, and he did the milah. So since Mamre was the one who gave him the positive advice to yes, do the milah, Hashem bestowed his presence in Mamre's area. One of the major mefarshim on the Medrash, the Anaf Yosef, the Eitz Yosef, he quotes from a relatively obscure sefer, why was Avram even asking the question to begin with? Meaning from everything we know about Avraham, then obviously he's going to do whatever Hashem says. And he's not hesitant to put his life on the line, even when it's not an explicit command, even when he's going to war and against, you know, insurmountable odds, just to save Lot, which Hashem did not command him to do. He did it just because it was the right thing to do. He's not so concerned that his life is at stake. That being the case, if Hashem explicitly told him to do a bris milah, why is he asking his advisor should he do it or not? So the Anaf Yosef answers that this Avram knew he was going to do it, but he wanted to know what his advisors were going to say. With the conception that he was now entering a new, you know, level in his life where he was getting the bris milah that was going to change his relationship with Hashem. He was going to be a more spiritual and developed, a more perfect person. Who should his friends be at this stage? The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, "Harchek mishachein ra." You have to distance yourself from somebody who's going to be a negative influence on you. So he asked his three closest friends, what do you say about this situation I'm about to go through? And the first two, what they told him was not evil in any way. Quite the opposite. They were very concerned for Avram's welfare. There was great well-being in their statements and their sentiment. But on the other hand, they were saying, don't do what Hashem tells you to do. And that was not the kind of influence that Avram could tolerate anymore. It was only his third friend, Mamre, who said, obviously, you do what Hashem says. So because of that, Avram relocated. That's why he was in Elone Mamre to begin with, because Mamre was the one he felt was closest in how he viewed the world and who would continue to be a positive influence upon him. If we move on to the next Rashi, the end of the third line, Yoshev, he was sitting. Yashav Ksiv, it said he, this is a grammar thing, the way we pronounce it as if there's a vav after the yud, Yoshev, but the way it's written, which we can see in the Chumash there, it's written without a vav, which if you were to read it without nekudos, you would just read it automatically, Yashav. So that distinction, that, comparison or contrast leads to a drasha. So what's the drasha Chazal had come out from this? Rashi says, Yashav Ksiv, Bikesh Lamod. Abraham, when he realized Hashem's presence was there, he sought to stand up. So Amar Lei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shav Vani Amod. No, you sit and I will stand, said Hashem. You stay sitting. Meaning Hashem did not allow Avram to get up in his presence. V'ata sim levanacha, and you will become a simon, a sign, a harbinger for your children. Sha'asid ani lisyatse badas hadayanim v'hen yoshvin. In the future, I will stand amongst the judges of the Sanhedrin, and they will sit. A judge is supposed to sit when he judges. Shenemar, how do we know Hashem stands amongst judges? As the Pasuk says, Elokim nitza badaskel, that Hashem stands in the congregation of God, which in the context is referring to the judges. So what's going on here? The Gur Aryeh says that first of all, it's rather peculiar that Hashem did not allow Avram to do a mitzvah. We know from our teachings in Ben Adam Lechaveru and interpersonal relations that if somebody wants to do something good, you have to let them do it, right? Even on a simple level, sometimes a person wants to say thank you, and we feel, you just meant, don't worry, not a problem. So that's not always a good response. Even though we want to, say, don't worry, it's not a big deal. It doesn't require a whole fanfare. But sometimes a person has to say thank you. And it's a chesed for them if you allow them to say thank you. And so let them do it. Or giving a present. And sometimes we don't want to accept a present. But if somebody puts effort into giving you a present, then acknowledge it. Make a little bit of a fanfare over it. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach Zatzal, when he was a guest by a certain home at one point, and he was complimenting to no end the wife who was cooking and the food she made and how tasty it was. He never had such a good meal. And when they left, one of the people with him, they knew that's not who he was. He didn't care about food. He was not a foodie for sure. And he was already at that point in his life where he had transcended that. It wasn't a thing for him anymore. So what we never hear you speak that way. So what do you mean? This woman, she put a lot of effort in, and it was just because she respected us. And even if I don't deserve the respect per se, but I acknowledge her effort, and it gave her such joy to know that I acknowledged her effort, that I thought it was tasty, and that I appreciate what she did for me. It wasn't a chesed for me, it was a chesed for her. So here, Abraham wants to respect Hashem. He wants to stand up, and yet he's being told you're not allowed to. Why? Because he has to act as a siman for future generations. And that siman is that as a judge, or his children who will be judges, Hashem will stand in their midst while they're sitting. This follows, why now at this point does this lesson come out? The Maharal says because we're following the mitzvah of milah. And as we discussed, when we discussed the philosophy behind the mitzvah of milah, it symbolized a lessening of one's physical interaction with the world, one's desire of a physical nature, and it's a very symbolic mitzvah from that perspective. Man is willing to forego some of his physical engagement with the world for the sake of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's sacrificing that to be more in line with Hashem's Ratzon. So that being the case, that is a fundamental prerequisite for somebody to be a judge. In order for, when we say that Hashem stands amongst the judges, the concept of judgment is, when we judge somebody, meaning not when we personally, but when the judges judge somebody, the case comes before them and they have to decide what the proper ruling is. Everything could turn like on a dime. It's the laws are so complex, especially in business law, when you have two different sides in front of you and both of them are yelling and swearing that they're correct, and they both have legitimate arguments, but you have to know what the halacha actually says, and the cases could be ridiculously complex with so many moving parts to them. And the halacha will give you broad categories and principles, which you then have to run through, 10, 15, 20 principles as it applies to this case, and decide how those principles interact with each other and what should take precedence, and at the end, what the proper decision is. It's almost superhuman to expect that somebody should be able to do so, right? We don't do well with too many factors going on at once when we have to integrate them and come out to a unified decision. Well, obviously, humans in general are famously bad at these kinds of things, that when we try to predict systems which have multiple factors in them, like the weather or the economy, things of that nature, they're just... they're too complex, right? It's we can't do it. So it's no different for something as complex as human nature, halacha, Torah, which is infinite, and applying it practically, telling people, who wins in this case and what that win should look like. It needs divine assistance. So as a recognition of that, Hashem says, for judges who are trying to do their job properly, I will always stand with them and make sure that the answer they give is the correct answer. Meaning it's beyond their ability. I acknowledge that. So as long as they put in their maximum effort, I will push it in the right direction as well. Why is that following Bris Milah, though? Why is this a lesson past Bris Milah? Because a judge can't be bribed, right? One of the major halachas applying to judges is that we are very, from a Torah perspective, very, 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 very suspect of any bribe whatsoever. And it doesn't have to be an ostentatious bribe where somebody hands the judge, an envelope or something like that. The Gemara records cases of somebody just getting a gift from, a few months before. And then when that person happened to come in their court case, to their court to have a judgment rendered, the rabbi had to say, I'm sorry, because a few months ago you gave me a gift, I might have an inclination towards your side. I'm no geya. I have a bias because of that, a positive bias towards you, and therefore I'm not allowed to judge your case. And even if the person was just nice to them in a way that they normally weren't, the same thing, that once there's some engagement between the judge and the Baal Din and the litigant in a way that might potentially bias them, and something, again, as small as just saying good morning in a friendly way so that you like the person, that's enough to say that the judge has to recuse himself from a halachic perspective and not be the one to judge this case. There has to be an absolute intellectual fidelity to the truth that cannot be influenced by any personal feelings whatsoever when judging between two people. In the Kovetz Ma'amar from Rebbe Chanan Wasserman Zatzal, he says that the Sefer starts off with a fundamental question, the mitzvah of Emunah, which we know is important, and the Rambam paskins the mitzvah of belief, believing in God, is a mitzvah. It's actually not so simple that it should be a mitzvah. There are Rishonim who hold that believing in God is not a mitzvah, it's not a commandment. Not that you don't have to believe in God. Of course you do, but it can't be a mitzvah, because in order for there to be a concept of a mitzvah, there has to be somebody commanding you, right? So the whole concept of a mitzvah, you know, assumes that there's a God. How can you have a mitzvah to believe in God if you don't have, you know, somebody commanding you? So, however, the Rambam does paskin, he does rule, that's a mitzvah, that you have to believe in God. So Rabbi Chanan says, this is a very perplexing mitzvah. Why so? Because first of all, one of the places we know this mitzvah from is, like we say every day, in Shema, Lo sasur achrei levavchem, you should not stray after your hearts. And we find that often the lev, the heart, is what is being spoken about when we talk about emunah, belief in God. And Rabbi Chanan says, why is that? We know, and Gemara talks about the head of a person, the moach of a person, it recognizes that the seat of intellect is in a person's brain, it's in their head. Why does it keep talking about the heart when talking about our religious beliefs or our religious knowledge or whether we've intellectually accepted God or not? So that's one question. The second question, he says, is we find such importance attached to this mitzvah of belief in God, but it should be one of the things which you would think is the least possible that it should be a mitzvah. Belief, we, you know, based on our cultural growth in America here, it's a personal matter. So you either believe or you don't believe. You happen to believe, the other person doesn't believe. So we don't fault the person who believes. We don't fault the person who doesn't believe, because they don't believe. Sue them. Like, what are you supposed to do? If you don't believe, you don't believe. So that being the case, how can we fault people who don't believe? How can there be such an emphasis in the Torah on believing in God? And we will punish people who don't believe. If they worship Avodah Zarah, it could be they really believe. They truly have bought into the Avodah Zarah, so much so, the Chumash tells us the Avodah Zarah of Molech was an Avodah Zarah where they would actually sacrifice their children. It was a big stone Avodah Zarah with its hands like this, and they would light a fire under the hands, and they would put a baby, a child, over the fire, and it would be consumed.
I often wonder about what was the attraction. Gee, I just love to burn my kids in the fire, you know, to Moloch or whatever. But what was the attraction of that? I mean, when you have Hashem, right, he says, "I don't want you to do that."
Right, right.
Yeah, this other one says, "Do it." What's the attraction?
So we don't understand it. The attraction to Avodah Zarah in general seems foreign to us. Like, we don't have a desire to worship a different pagan conception. So the Gemara talks about that during the second Beis HaMikdash, the Yetzirah for the evil inclination for idol worship, Chazal went through a mystical process where they got rid of it. They said there are two Yetzaharas, the Gemara records this, there are two Yetzaharas, two evil inclinations, which are just decimating the Jewish people, meaning we're not making it. God said, be good, and these two things are killing us. One was the penchant for idolatry, and one was the Avodah Zarah for illegal physical liaisons, adultery and whatnot, that the Jews also were not doing well with. So Chazal said, even though it's better for us to have the nisayon, the test, and for us to pass it, but if you know the person's not passing the test, they're failing the test, then you have to take a step back and remove them from the test because they can't handle it. So at that point in time, Chazal saw, the rabbis of the time saw, the Jews weren't making it with those Yetzaharas. And they went through the Gemara describes how it was, we'll get into the details now, a mystical process where they were able to remove those desires from the Jewish people as a whole. The desire for idol worship and the desire for, let's say, adultery, arayas. And the The Gemara says they woke up the next morning, they had removed that desire from the world, meaning it wasn't peculiar to the Jewish people. If you're removing something on a natural level, you're removing it from nature as a whole. So it said they woke up the next morning and the chickens had stopped laying eggs. Meaning when there's no desire in the world, people stop moving, animals stop moving to a certain degree. So they saw that they weren't, that the world would not continue without that taiva in the world as well. So they allowed that taiva back into the world. But the one for idol worship was kept strictly out. So that caused a great divide where until that time, they had this immense desire for idol worship, just like we today have an equivalent desire for licentious behavior, meaning we want to look at what we want to look at and we want to be with who we want to be with. And that's a consuming desire for people, even though it doesn't necessarily make sense. And sometimes it could be there's no chance of procreation. The person, you know, everybody else thinks that they're not attractive. Whatever it may be, it's just an irrational desire to be with that person for no reason whatsoever. So that kind of irrational desire, which we find in physical relationships, Chazal said that's what they experienced for idol worship as well. Your question is very well taken. Abaya, actually, in the Gemara, asked the question. He was lecturing about on Tanakh, about King Menashe, who was considered an evil king for the Jewish people. And he called him our friend Menashe, meaning he was belittling him in the lecture he was giving. And that night, Menashe appeared to him in a dream and started quizzing him in Torah. And Abaya was one of the great Torah leaders of the generation. And he reduced him to tears, basically. The Gemara says he was asking him questions that Abaya found he wasn't able to answer. Menashe was, you know, infinitely greater than him in his Torah knowledge. I don't know if I told you, when I applied for Kollel in YU, where I went to Kollel for a number of years, so Rav Schachter, he's the Rosh Kollel, and he knows everything. Mm-hmm. The way it worked is you go to him and he quizzes you on things, and then he either gives you the thumbs up or thumbs down for the whether or not you got into to Kollel. So the nature, when I applied for the Kollel, I was engaged to my wife, and he went for the summer to the same place where my in-laws used to go for the summer, Tannersville, which is, near New York, upstate a little bit, in the woods and mountains. And so he had a place there, and they had a place there. So I went up there for the Shabbos. So he was sitting on his front porch learning all day, and I came up for my faher, for my test for the Kollel. So he starts asking questions, you know, softballs to begin with. But then, to determine your knowledge, where are you holding in your Torah study? And then he continues asking. They get a little harder, and then he starts asking you obscure topics like agricultural law, which nobody in America knows about anything, and then, you know, the laws of Tumantara, and then more advanced questions and business. And so at some point, like, how many times can you say, I don't know, right? You're sitting there crying, like, okay, you got me. I'm sorry I wasted your time. And that's it. So when I was at that point, my wife happened to be walking by, future wife, and he calls out from the porch, he passed with flying colors. So he was being nice, but I did get into the Kollel in the end. But so that's what Abaya was feeling like. Menashe just grilled him, and Abaya realized he's sitting in the presence of somebody truly great who he's not even remotely near his level. So Abaya said, I don't understand then. If you're so great, how could you worship idols? Like, and you were one of the big instigators in the Jewish people. And Menashe said, you don't understand. If you had been living in our days, you would have picked up your robe to run after the idols. Like, you don't realize what the desire was for idol worship. It was an irrational desire. And obviously we can intellectualize what they thought they were trying to accomplish. It wasn't stupid, but the desire for it, the attraction, was irrational at its core. There's a lot to be said about that. Maybe in a different shir, we could go through that.
Is this the Menashe from Ephraim
and Menashe? No. This was a few thousand, a thousand years later or so, but Menashe was one of the kings after the kingdom, meaning there was David, let's say Shaul, David, Shlomo, and then Shlomo's son Rechavam. He was the fourth king. And then during Rechavam, the Jewish country split. Hashem decreed it to be that way. So Rechavam was the king over, we call it the area of Yehuda, and Yeravah ben Nevat, who was at the time of the split, a very righteous, also genius person, he became the king of what we call Yisrael, Melch Yisrael. But then Yeravam took a left turn, again, outside the scope of this year right now, where he introduced idol worship into the nation as a systemic behavior. And then, pursuant to that, a number of kings followed his lead, including Menashe, who really doubled down on Avodah Zarah within the Jewish people.
Maybe a couple weeks ago now.
So Rav Chanan says, how can you have a mitzvah of emunah? Meaning, you either believe or you don't believe. It doesn't make sense that we should castigate people if, for whatever reason, they don't believe. To answer all of these questions, he says it's even greater, right? When does a person have to start keeping mitzvahs? Is when they're bar mitzvah. And at 13 years old, or a girl when she's 12 years old, a bas mitzvah. And already they have a mitzvah of emunah at that tender young age. And the Rambam himself, when he speaks about Aristotle, who he adored, he said Aristotle's intellect was so developed that the only thing he was missing was prophecy, meaning he felt that Aristotle had actualized the human intellect to such a degree that you couldn't go any higher without divine assistance at that point. That's how much he thought of Aristotle. But even Aristotle, he didn't believe. He didn't have this emunah. So Rabbi Chanan asks, if Aristotle, who's the greatest genius, did not come to emunah, how can we expect, the kid, who today I'm a fountain pen, expect him to have emunah? What's going on there? So Rabbi Chanan, to answer all of these questions, he writes, it must be then that emunah is not the great intellectual, achievement that we make it out to be, but rather it must be obvious. It must be clear that there's a world and that Hashem created the world and that there's a creator to the world. Obviously, we can argue about the details of who that creator is, but the fact that there's a creator to the world, that there should be no question about. If you woke up with a developed intellect and you saw the world there, obviously you would assume there's a creator without a question. If you look at a machine, obviously the machine, right? The famous example is a watch. The watch didn't make itself. Clearly, somebody created the watch. Nobody except a crazy person would think that the watch self-assembled all of its little pieces together to become a working watch. Or if you find a book where it just so happens somebody threw ink and magically it formed words and letters in the book. It doesn't work like that. Nature doesn't work like that. The scientist today, say it does work like that. I come from a science background. I have a degree in biology. That it gets me upset when I read the people who argue, pro-evolution and that there's no God, et cetera, et cetera. Not because I'm fiery religious and therefore everybody's evil, blah, blah, blah. That's not true. Meaning a person can have a legitimate intellectual argument. But when you read the arguments, they're fallacious. There's always like one part where the argument goes off the rails, which they're covering over via their rhetoric from the secular side without acknowledging the truth of the question that could lead you in a different direction. And I'm not saying that question should lead you to believing in Yiddishkeit, but at least it could be better for science. Don't paper over the questions in science if you don't have a good answer yet. You're keeping the science itself from progressing when you don't acknowledge the questions. Specifically in evolution, when one studies the, just to address one point, the complexity of organisms and the human cells and the mechanisms within the cells, and then the mechanisms within those mechanisms, it's like really complex machines all the way down. It never gets simple. There's no point where, like, okay, the cell's complex like a factory, but the things within the factory are just hunks of metal which we string together in units to make things happen. In cells, in living life, it's not like that. Each of those little machines within the cell are crazy complex. And within those machines, the systems that are going on are crazy complex. Even you could Google it later, the Krebs cycle, which is considered one of the basic processes, one of the very simple processes within the cell that does, you'll find out what it is, does what it does, is when you see it mapped out, it's like looking at the New York City subway map. It's crazy lines everywhere, and that's at the most basic, easy to understand fundamental nature. And then that system has to work with another system of equal complexity. And those systems have to work all together. If you take a computer, right, on one hand, a very complex computer, and you have a car on the other, and you just smoosh them together, right? How well are they going to integrate? Obviously something else is going on. It didn't happen by chance. It needs some kind of conscious design to get those things to integrate together and to even make the machine itself. The fallacy that's found in much of the otherwise legitimate scientific writing on this topic from Richard Dawkins and others, and he's a very engaging, super intelligent individual, and he writes, it's fun to read when he writes. He's very convincing as well. But it always, in this specific area, goes back to this fallacy that it's simple on, down beneath, and sometimes simple things can come together in complex ways. The truth, as any scientist knows, is that it's complex all the way down. There's no part where it's just simple and two or three simple pieces come together to make a mousetrap. That's just not the reality, and he knows it's not the reality, and that's I feel that's just bad science. Forget about religion. I want to see science progress. So Rabbi Chanan says that when any intelligent person, if they just looked at the world rationally, of course something's going on. Of course there's a creator. Of course it didn't self-construct in all of its complexity. So that being the case, why do our big geniuses, even our big scientific geniuses, the Aristotles of the world, or whoever your favorite modern-day Nobel Prize-winning physicist is, why don't they believe in a creator? So he says the reason for that is we have a pasuk. And the pasuk comes from the halachos of judges. As we said, the prerequisite for a judge is he can't accept bribes. Why? The pasuk says explicitly, shochad ya'aver enei chachamim, that bribery blinds the eyes of the righteous, of the chachamim, of the wise people. That as soon as you have any kind of netiyah, any kind of bias whatsoever, you're no longer going to be thinking straight, right? We've all experienced with children, when they want something, you can rationally explain to them why it's not good for them, but they will cry and convince you from here to tomorrow why you're the idiot for not allowing them to have it, and you're being irrational, and da-da-da. It's clear. Any thinking person will see this is not a good thing for them. But because they want it, for whatever need it fulfills in them, they have constructed their mind a billion intellectual rational arguments why it has to be the way they want it to be. What's giving truth to those arguments is just they want it for whatever reason. And as soon as they, are able to step back, maybe it might be a year later, they realize, of course, I'm glad my parents did that for me. Like, they didn't allow me to jump off the roof or whatever it was that they wanted to do, right? That would have been silly. So Rabbi Chanan says we have desires. Everybody lives with taiva, and that taiva, that desire, acts as a shochad. It acts as a kind of bribery. It creates a bias in our perception of the world. So because of that, when when we look at the world and what should be an obvious conclusion that Hashem created it, we're drawn back from that because if Hashem created it, it means there's a purpose. And it means we must right have to do things in a certain way. But we don't want to do them that way. We want to do it in this way. So that influences the way we think about, well, did Hashem really create the world? Is it really the way the Torah says? And we start making all these intellectual, rational arguments which allow us to fulfill our taiva in a way that doesn't allow us to acknowledge what's the obvious reality of the world. So that's why here is specifically Hashem is giving Avraham a siman for Dayanim, for judges in the future, that Avraham, you were willing to take that step and you were willing to step back from your taiva, from your being a personality fixated on desire. You were willing to take a step back from that, remove yourself from by having a bris milah. Now that you've removed your physical bias in your approach to life, you can now you become the symbol of what the future judges are supposed to be. One who views the world rationally and intellectually and objectively, and that allows you to come to the right decision.
Rabbi, can I ask you a quick question? Why do you think scientists have a bias? Or like, what's their bias?
The same thing. They live in a world of desire. I mean, to be human is to desire. A person has to work on themselves to counter that in order to view things objectively. Okay, well, there's more Rashi's here. It's hard to get past the first pasuk when Rashi keeps talking, but Yitzhak, I will try to move right to next time. Okay. Yeah.